Hello, everyone. Great to be back here. And we had lots of rain last night, which is very welcoming because we needed it, especially where I live on Waiheke Island at the moment. And we have, I say every week we have a special guest because every week all our guests are special. And we have Deborah Lamshire, and she's going to talk about hearing voices and psychosis. Hello, Deborah.
Hello, Robin. Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay. And Deborah comes from a lived experience background of mental health. She's a professional teaching fellow at Auckland University, where she works across all disciplines in mental health to inform students of the actual experience of mental distress. She also works for ADHB, working with people who experience distressing voices. And so, Deborah, could you tell us about hearing voices, what actually is hearing, you know, the experience of hearing voices in your own experience?
Okay. I started hearing things that other people didn't when I was quite young, and that was something that continued right through and continues still to current day. So it took me a while to realise that people couldn't hear what I heard, and what I did hear were people talking to me, or sometimes I could hear different sounds, et cetera, et cetera. So I soon discovered when I got to my early teens that actually hearing things, being able to hear things that other people weren't hearing, wasn't actually okay, that people actually thought you were crazy. So what I learnt from that was to not tell anybody about it. They didn't stop. They continued on, and I started to have some real difficulties with them. When I was younger, I didn't have too many problems with them. They were okay. And I suppose as a child, you think they're kind of like your friends, and you know, and they were kind and they were fun, etc. I was a very lonely child, so they kind of felt like my on-tap friends 24/7, which I didn't have. And like I said, it wasn't really until I got to be a teenager, around about 13, that they started to turn nasty. Mm-hmm. And they started to say some very derogatory and very negative things about me. And when I sort of shared some of my experience with my peer group, they all laughed and I was very humiliated, and I kind of felt from them, when you're 13, those things are really important, that your peers accept you. So I stopped talking about them.
Okay. So especially time during adolescence,
when
you're trying to find your identity, merging into adulthood, and people are, you know, making fun of you. And
absolutely.
And that must have been a very lonely and isolating time, more so than normal adolescence, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
And we won't go too much into your time at Kingsead Hospital, but when you were 17, you went there and you passed through white stucco gate that said loony bin on painted on the side, and you weren't worried because you didn't think you'd be staying there, and then you did, though. So you did stay there for a period of time.
A long, long period of time. I was at Kingsead and also some other mental institutions as well. And it was a shock. Going there was a real shock for me, because, like you say, I thought I was just going to be in and out, etc. But what did happen there was I met a group of people who were incredibly courageous, who were incredibly kind, and were very accepting. And it wasn't the staff; it was the fellow patients, as we were called then. Mm-hmm. And so I found a place where I found that I was safe. I felt safe there in a way with my new peers. And I could talk about the crazy, whatever that was. I could talk about that stuff. And people didn't judge, and they understood what was happening. And so I had an opportunity to talk. The people you didn't get the opportunity to talk to were frequently the staff, because the thinking of the day was that you don't talk to people about their voices or what they're hearing or what's going on for them, because you're feeding into their delusion as such. And delusion implies that something's not real, and my reality was that I was hearing things. Just because other people couldn't hear them didn't mean it wasn't happening. And so it made the voices and myself kind of go underground. So I had to be very secretive about them. And the only people I could be open about what they were saying and what was happening and the sort of things that they were inviting me to do or demanding that I do, the only people I could share that with were the other patients there. So it was, in some ways, a respite. Unfortunately, the treatment, and it wasn't really a treatment, it was the approach, it was considered the treatment, was heavy medication. So what ended up happening was you were very heavily medicated, incredibly sedated, so you couldn't actually do anything, and you had this kind of cotton, like cotton wool in your brain. You couldn't think clearly. And I'm sort of a firm believer that you think your way into madness, so therefore you can think your way out. And the way to think your way out is to dialogue, I believe, is to have discussions with people, and to get alternative views and different ways of looking at things. If it's internalised and you're silenced by the so-called treatment, which is what happened with the heavy medication, then it becomes very an internalised process and you've got no way of sifting through it. And I think it actually increases the madness. You just really get madder and madder because you've got no outlet, nowhere for it to go, and it's the only thing that makes sense is that you must be mad.
Right. I can't imagine, Deborah. When I was watching one of your YouTube videos, you revisited the place where you stayed for many years, and it was quite, what I've been looking at was quite bittersweet. You didn't like the way you were treated and dehumanized by staff, but you created these really close bonds with the other patients. Do you want to share a little bit about your experience with that? And my other question is, do you still keep in touch with some of the people?
Unfortunately, I was the youngest person when I was there. Unfortunately, most of them have passed away now. So, no, I don't. I'd probably be in more trouble if I was saying that I was keeping in touch with them. End up back inside, probably. Or I'd get my own TV show, I'm not quite sure. Yeah. But what was so therapeutic, I think, was being with people who'd been through similar experiences, that things, it gave you a benchmark in terms of what we had the opportunity to do and what we talked about. We talked less about, I suppose, what was happening to us at that present time and more about what had happened to us. So it was much more about our life stories and our circumstances and what had brought us to this place. And through doing that, through that that storytelling and having that narrative, you kind of could see how things made sense. Because even when I was at my maddest, and I do call it madness, it's just a more comfortable term for me, even when I was at my maddest, I was still competent in certain areas. This idea that when you're mad, you're completely incompetent and can't think clearly is a misnomer. There's always some part of yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the hope sits, is that even when you're at your maddest, you often know that something's not right. You're not sure what it is, and you're not sure how to make it right, but you know something's not right, and you're desperately trying to pull those threads together so you're that person, the person that you want to be again.
Right. And in some ways, it sounds like, when I'm reflecting about what you're saying, is that you seem to have great insight to think there's a better way to deal with these voices than get heavily medicated. And you had ECT, and that was more of a form of punishment than treatment. Mm. So when we're going to take a break now and we come back, we'll talk more about hearing voices with Deborah.
Lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. It's Dr. Robin. We're back here at Flea FM, and we are talking to Deborah Lamshar about hearing voices and psychosis. Welcome back, Deborah. And would you tell us a little bit about how common is it for people to be hearing voices? What's the prevalence, roughly?
Sure. The international research shows that 1 in 25 people hear voices, which works out roughly to about 8% of the population. So it's much more prevalent than people realise. What's not quite so common as such is that the distress that's associated with it. So people can have different explanations. It can be a religious experience. It could be an experience of a spiritual nature as such of some form. And it doesn't cause people that level of distress. And people who come into mental health services generally come in not because they're hearing voices, because hearing voices in itself is not an issue. It's what the voices are saying to you. So it's the content of the voice that causes the distress.
Okay. So it's, as you were saying, you had a very positive voice when you first started hearing voices. Somebody actually was very nurturing to you and kept
Correct.
You company until you reached adolescence. Then the voices went negative. But it's not always, what I've read in papers too, when you hear about somebody that had committed a crime, it's because this voice had told them to do it. It's not that everyone that hears voices are going to act upon them or act negative in a way, or a voice that tells you to do something. Can you tell me a little bit about those, the variety of voices, and then we'll talk about managing them later.
Absolutely. Voices in terms of people committing crimes under the influence of voices is an extraordinary and very rare event. In terms of criminality, it's much more likely to be 18 to sort of 34-year-old males as such. So it is an extraordinary event. Unfortunately, the media has taken it upon themselves. They are not an ally of people who experience mental distress, and often the stories get sensationalised. Mm-hmm. And if we wanted to talk about sort of misinformation, a lot of that is people are informed actually by the media and they take what they say as an absolute truth. But research and experience actually shows that it's the total opposite, that actually people who have in mental health services are more likely to be the recipients of violence and be a product of violence than they are to be the perpetrator of any violence. So often what we see in services is multiple traumas.
Right.
And that's, so in terms of perpetrating anything, it is more likely that people are the victims rather than the perpetrators. And these are people who have often been ravaged by multiple traumas that they haven't been able to give voice to or have not been believed. Particularly in the area of abuse. It wasn't that long ago in terms of if people reported particularly sexual abuse that they weren't believed. And, of course, the consequences of that is that people very much internalise that anger and their heart it gets filled with a fury, but they turn that fury on themselves.
Right. And do you think that some of the people to medicate on top of medication, or if they're not taking medication, do they tend to self-medicate as well?
Yeah, it's a very common, and the people in the general public do this too. You know, a lot of people drink and drug take because they're very shy, and it's a way for them to come out of themselves. And the majority of the people that we see, well over half would be using drugs and alcohol as a way to try and mitigate the impact of their voices. Mm-hmm. So it's actually a coping mechanism that comes into place that actually ends up being another issue. But of course, if you deal with the drinking and drug taking and the voices are still there and they're still vilifying you and abusing you and using all sorts of derogatory terms and phrases about you, then there's nothing to protect you from that.
Right.
So it's a sort of a two-pronged attack. You need to attack, you need to address both issues at the same time. And we need to look at the reason why people are drinking and drug taking and why people see that as a way, because it's much more, I think, of a societal issue. I don't think it, as such it's a mental health issue. I think it's a societal issue, our attitudes towards alcohol, our attitudes towards getting out, and why people feel this need not to stay in the world but find another place to go.
Right, and there's so much stigma that revolves around anyone with any type of, you know, what we use the term mental illness, which is a stigma in itself, that label, and I
Absolutely.
Think we should get rid of that label.
Yeah.
And I think also people that with any kind of illness, so particularly hearing voices, is that do they feel like outsiders and people are not going to accept them, and their self-esteem is greatly impaired because of that.
I think the level of self-loathing that I've experienced from people who hear voices is sort of, it's almost unbelievable. It's incomprehensible how the loathing of the selves. And that's because they're not only getting a message, their own self-talk telling them they're nothing but a piece of shite, they're also getting voices that are telling them a lot worse than that. And they're getting it for hours and hours on end. And I would say that nobody's ego is able to tolerate that constant assault. We're not built that way as human beings. And in fact, it would probably only be a narcissist as such who would be able to tolerate that. Possibly Donald Trump, I think he could probably tolerate it. But apart from that, I think we're just not built for that. And this is what people are contending with, you know, being constantly put down and then going into the community and equally facing the social exclusion, so the multiple ways that people in the general public are finding to exclude people without possibly meaning to as such. And, you know, the eyes down, not talking to people, not smiling, etc. You can only take so much rejection before it starts projecting on yourself that it must be you, because people don't do that to other people, they only do it to me. And I think while we have talked a lot about COVID and being isolated and the impact generally on people's mental health, I think the plague in our community, the ongoing plague, is loneliness and isolation. Mm-hmm. And if we've learnt anything from this episode of COVID, what we've learnt is we are social beings and we need each other, and we need each other for a reason. Just because somebody else has identified me or labelled me correctly or incorrectly as being mentally ill does not mean that I don't have the same needs, wants and desires as anybody else. Mm-hmm. When I was at school, we had to write a list of what we wanted to be when we grew up. And the other kids put pop stars and movie stars and astronauts and racing car drivers, etc. And at the top of my list was, I want to be somebody's best friend. Because I think I was about 12 or 13 at the time, and it saddens me now to think that as a 13-year-old that was the pivotal of my being, because I needed somebody else in my life to let me know that I was worth it. And the way we value people is by having relationships with people. So it only needs to be one person that tells me that I matter for me to believe it, because I can't believe it of myself.
Right, so that was, it was a long journey for you, but it still touches you back then when you're thinking about the pain that was involved at that point in time and how you carried it for many years before, you know, you decided to
And I think
look
people
at it.
Possibly wouldn't think of that as a trauma, and I wouldn't identify it as a trauma as such. Maybe all the associated stuff that got me there with small snippets that got me there. But trauma by its very nature is a sort of an ember that constantly burns, and then when a memory can provoke it and it goes, it inflames it. So trauma generally does not have an expiry date. So what you do is you learn to live with it and you learn from it. Mm. It's not necessarily something you can avoid or have been able to avoid even in the future, but there is a lesson in it that you can learn, and you no longer have to be held, you don't have to be held captive by it. Mm-hmm. You can just allow it. But that also doesn't mean that you can't have a little cry about it every now and again, or let it touch you in some ways, because I think people who often experience mental distress are quite sensitive people, and I don't want to be in a society that has to apologise for being sensitive to others. I'm as sensitive about myself, but I'm also highly sensitive to others, and so therefore that means that I'm going to give. Because I understand for others what it's like to truly be lonely. And in fact, I would probably say the loneliest people in our community are older adults.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Older adults.
Older adults generally are the loneliest people. And there was some research done that showed that 18 to 24-year-olds, and I was shocked to find that they identified themselves as lonely. Mm-hmm. And I keep thinking, it doesn't make sense. It seems like an oxymoron, having so many people that are lonely. So people are searching and seeking company and each other and human kindness and connectedness. Mm. And in this age of being able to get anywhere in 2 minutes flat, etc., why are we not finding each other?
Right, right. And I think that, you know, this is another thing. It was good research to look at, you know, the prevalence of, you know, that 18 to 24-year-old, and they're the loneliest group, whereas the person who did the study, you know, the older people, they sort of found themselves, they found interests and they enjoy their own company, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, everyone has experienced pockets of loneliness, particularly during this COVID age, where I can't jump on an airplane and go to Boston to see mommy, you know, and I don't have a partner, and you know, I've got a dog. Thank God I've got a dog, you know.
Oh yes.
but getting back to the whole stigma too, Deborah, is if you're depressed, somebody was like, I was told once when I said I was depressed that, oh, there's people worse off than you. That's not very helpful to me. You know,
it's not helpful to anyone.
I know. I thought, oh my God. And so just be empathic with people. You know, if they say they're depressed, don't tell them, oh, suck it up. You know, those
it's
are the things.
It's invalidating.
Yeah.
Because if someone's had the courage to tell you, look, this is how I feel and this is what's going on for me, appreciate that as a privilege that someone trusts you enough to share something that private. And
exactly.
That personal with you, they're telling you because they think that you're the sort of person who would respond kindly to that. And it's very invalidating when someone, like you say, just says, oh, get over it. What have you got to be depressed about?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Or, you see celebrities and they're depressed, or they, you know, decide to take their lives, or, you know, not just a celebrity, but anyone who gets to that bottom, and people would say, oh, why didn't they come and talk to us? Well, it's because stigma, because we're told it's not okay, otherwise you're mentally ill. But anyways, we're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk about how to deal with hearing voices. Hello, everyone. It's Dr. Robin back here on Flea FM, and we are talking to Deborah Limsher, who has she's a lived experience, and you have expertise in hearing voices. And over the break, we were talking about gender differences in hearing voices. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that, Deborah? It was really interesting.
Yeah. It sort of appears that with men tend to start hearing voices in their early teens. That's very common, up to their 30s sort of thing. And with men, often the voice hearing experience is more overt. So in terms of how people behave and act and respond and actively respond to voices and that, their appearance is more overt, I suppose, in public or at home amongst family, etc. So it often gets picked up quicker. Women tend to hide what's going on for them and are much better at actually keeping their, you know, their presentation as such and their effects underground a bit more. So it can sort of, I suppose, skew the ideas in terms of men tend to come into the services earlier and women tend to come in a little bit later.
Okay.
Generally.
Okay, that's good to know as well. And can you tell us about you do groups in hearing voices. Can
yes.
you tell us, like, you know, some of the strategies you teach, and do some people learn to deal with their, you know, the hearing voices with or without medication, or is it a combination of both?
I work at in a DHB, and most of the people who attend the group would be on medication, but not necessarily so. And my expertise is not medication, so I don't tend to have those discussions or go there as such. My expertise, if anything, is in dealing with the distressing voices. And what I was very fortunate to be able to do was when I got out of the Institute, I sort of worked very consciously on my voices, and I discovered some things about them that put me in a position where I was able to have pretty much complete control over them. I must confess, if I'm honest about it, I've never actually completely wanted to get rid of my voices, because I have good and bad voices. So I only work on my negative voices, the ones that cause me problems, the ones who tell me I'm fabulous and wonderful and, you know, my nana type of things and play that sort of role. They can stay. They're fine. So I had no wish to actually get rid of them completely, and because I'm so used to hearing them. But one of the things that I discovered very early on when I started sort of trying to observe and what was going on and sort of analyse a bit what was going on with them was I noticed a very strong connection with anxiety. And so I think of voices as an extreme response to anxiety, and I see them as dominated by anxiety. I don't see them as a psychotic disorder. I see them as associated with anxiety. So therefore, what I did was I worked very much on my anxiety, and what I noticed as a consequence of that, my negative voices reduced. And that gave me the opportunity to explore it a lot further. And then I was able to get to a position where I had a fairly clear understanding of the purpose of my voices. And surprisingly, my voices were actually trying to protect me. But they were doing it in a very harsh and brutal way. And their idea of protecting me was to isolate me, because something that you can learn from your childhood and from your adulthood, surely, is that while relationships are the single most rewarding experience we engage in, they can also be the most hurtful. And so what the voices were inadvertently doing was keeping me isolated and away from people so I wouldn't get hurt, because I'd kind of reached the threshold of hurt by the time the negative ones started coming in. And so I see them as a response to that. And what I worked on was I realized I was engaged in a relationship. It didn't matter that I didn't see them. People who were on Facebook and Twitter and Grindr and all those sorts of magical sort of email-y things, you can have a very intense relationship without actually seeing the person.
Right.
So that's the same, I put it in the same vein. etc. And so what I started set about doing is I wanted to change my relationship with the voices. And so that's what I started doing. And the first thing I did was I decided I was no longer going to treat them as my enemy. I was going to treat them as my friend. And I was going to treat them how I wish to be treated and respond and react to them with love and kindness. And I did that. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. But I just persisted. And what I found also was as I reclaimed my own power and control, because the voices are very much about power and control issues in your life. And as I began to feel more powerful and more in control of myself rather than them, I found that I could assert more authority. So I became more authoritative with them. Instead of saying, look, you can't really come to me when I'm at work because it's very distracting, but you can come to me when I'm in the car on the drive home. So I started to put parameters around our relationship. They don't always observe them as such because they're rebels at heart. But I can say to them, you have to wait till 5 minutes. I'll come back to you. And I always come back to them because I sort of came to thinking that actually for the voices themselves, they think that they have to protect me because they don't think I can protect myself. And so I had to sort of let them realize that I can protect myself now. I don't actually need them to do that for me. But unfortunately, they've got into a way of working. So it's a habit. It's like smoking, but it becomes a habit. So they don't know how to stop the habit. Now, I can't stop my voices from talking to me. I'm not able to do that. But what I can control is how I respond and react to them and how I let them impact on my life. That's what I can control. So I control what I can and I just let go what I can't and just run with it. And that's been sufficient for me to sort of not only reclaim my life, in fact, it hasn't even reclaimed it in lots of ways. My life has been able to flourish because of that, because I've created the path that I chose for myself, not what mental health professionals thought I was capable of. Because nobody thought I was capable of anything. I used to sit in a chair and just rock back and forth and drink coffee and smoke cigarettes, watching the clock, waiting for it to be 5:30 when I could go to bed. Nobody there saw the person in front of them now, someone who's relatively articulate and social and able to go out there and express themselves and connect with people. Nobody saw that person. That person lived inside. That was the ember. That's the ember of hope, waiting for the right time and the right person.
Right. Oh, wow. It sounds like it was a fascinating journey for you. You've really, your resiliency is just amazing, Deborah.
Oh, I think it's not, I think it's in terms of people's personal resourcefulness and personal resilience, you can't be in the mental health system and not have enormous amounts of resourcefulness and resilience. It just goes with the territory in lots of ways. It's just drawing that out. And to do that, you have to believe in yourself again. And I think that on that road to self-discovery was learning to love again. And not the learning to love, you had to learn to love yourself first. And I know it's a bit of a cliche, but until you think that you're of any value and you deserve and you're entitled to be here, then other people won't treat you as if you are.
And it seems like it's more of a challenge for people that are stigmatized in society.
Of course, yeah.
And, you know, they keep getting, you know, knocked down.
Absolutely.
And, you know, for example, say you go for employment or whatever, do you have to document that, you have this condition, you know, the people in general? Or can they say, no, I'm a person. Mm. It's not going to affect my work.
And I certainly didn't when I went for the jobs that I went for, because I think the question is, do you have any medical condition that would impact on your ability to work? And the answer is no. In fact, at work, I'm the person that uses the least amount of sick leave.
Wow.
because I've not only because I've managed to genetically be quite physically healthy as such, but because work is my healing, because I'm working with people who heal me. It's a reciprocal process. You can't teach without learning. I believe that. And you can't work with people and trying to engage them with their own healer and not learn and get some healing back. So it's a sense of reciprocity. So what you give, I get back 10 times. That's what gets me up every day. That's what gets me excited about going to work. That's what, that's my passion.
Right. Do you think that there are some people who hear voices are not as motivated as you? And can you give some thoughts about that? Is it because the constant, my speculation of knowing people that have gone through similar journeys, with that stigma, is that, part of it's the self-esteem, maybe part of it could be added depression, part of it could be PTSD from being institutionalized. So do you have any thoughts about that? Because you're very motivated and you're such an inspiration, but there are people that are still struggling, with having to get up and go and do something. The motivation for some people that have experienced is not there 100%.
Absolutely. And I think while I present that way now, that's not where I came from. Right. I was that so-called unmotivated person. And I don't believe that people are unmotivated. I think they just haven't found the spark yet. Right. They haven't found the right word, the right person, the right pet, the right something. People only change their behaviour if there's a reward in it. So there has to be something in it, because it's safer, particularly if you are a highly anxious person. You perceive the world very differently. You live in a dangerous world, because that's what anxiety tells you and that's what anxiety teaches you. But extending outside of that world, there's also a risk. And really, we've already endured the consequences of those risks of engaging in relationships and with other people. And it's just how many knocks we can take. And I think sometimes what people do, like I spent 18 years waiting to be cured and didn't realise that I held all the keys to my own